This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 326 was recorded on June 2nd, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by FarmTogether.com, where you can hedge against inflation and protect your portfolio by investing in U.S. farmland, now available to all accredited investors. Incrementum fund manager Ronnie Sterfeli, principal author of the In Gold We Trust report, returns as this week's feature interview guest. In Gold We Trust is out for 2022, and this year's theme is stagflation. We'll dive into that subject in depth on this week's gold-focused show. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will be titled What's Next for the Markets?
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into that S&P 500, which at this moment, obviously, the last week has been a bit of a bear market rally, obviously, from a very oversold condition. We're trading a stone throw away from 4,200. Do you think there's a little more upside here, or is this just a big fake out?
Well, Patrick, if this was just a bear market rally, there's a good argument to be made that it's either over or about to end, or maybe we'll get up to the 50 or even 100-day moving average, and then it'll end. Here's the way I'm looking at it, and I should acknowledge that I don't really have any strong view here, but I think the basis of this rally was the widespread perception that comments by various Fed officials meant that a pause was coming in the Fed's rate hiking cycle. Now, as I've said before on Macro Voice, I think that was some wishful thinking. I'm not really sure that the Fed is really set to pause. But what's going to decide that is going to be not what somebody said last week, but whether or not they're successful at fighting inflation. If inflation abates, that's going to be what allows this rally to continue, is continuing expectations by market participants that inflation has peaked, it's behind us, you know, it was transitory, and it's all going to be fine. And that could go on for quite a while, because even though my view is that inflation is not done here, definitely part of this was the transitory effect of the ending of the pandemic. And that will be transitory. That has contributed to this. So it makes sense that inflation is going to start to come off. And as it continues to come off, it's going to set more and more positive thinking into play, which could fuel the rally further. At some point, my prediction is we'll realize, oh, wait a minute, there really is more to this inflation than just the transitory effects of the end of the pandemic. But it's also the dozen or so years of incredible, or I would say excessively accommodative monetary policy that's brought about this inflation. Now, if that's the case, what you could expect is the market continues to rally until it becomes clear that inflation is back and it's not transitory and it's really coming to bite us. And at that point, I think the market's in big trouble because everybody knows the Fed is going to have no choice but to let the market fall in order to fight that inflation with higher rates. So I think it's all about inflation and inflation expectations. For now, I'm not sure if this is a bear market rally that's over or if it's set to continue. I think it's all about that set of inflation-related perceptions that will decide the answer.
All right, well, let's move on to that dollar index. We've obviously been in multiple weeks of a dollar correction. Yesterday, we had an attempt for the dollar to try to break out and gave it all back today. So we have a dollar index that's just below 102 and just grinding a bit. What's your take on the dollar here?
Well, grinding, I think, is the key word in what you said, and also multiple weeks. So since you said multiple weeks first, I won't feel too bad about saying same commentary as last week, which is basically we're pulling back from a five-year high. They call them resistance levels for a reason. They resist for a little bit before you can break through them. As long as we stay above 99, I think it's just a pullback. But, you know, this is a really major level at 104 and whatever it is, 104 spot something, where the previous high was from 5 years ago. ago. It could take 6 months of consolidation before we eventually break higher, but I think that we will. I really would love to get an update from Luke Groman, so we're going to work on trying to get him back on the show so we can talk about his longer-term view, or I think it's a longer-term view. I'll have to see what Luke thinks, that the dollar will eventually decline quite steeply as it loses its reserve currency status. I agree with Luke that that's coming. I don't think it comes till the end of this decade. I'm really curious to see what Luke's current thinking is, so we'll work on getting him scheduled for a new appearance soon.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. It's been making higher highs, been driving a nice trend higher, and obviously a bit of a wobble here on the OPEC news, but a very quick recovery, and we're trading on the July contract very close to 117. What's your take on crude, and how did inventory numbers come in?
Well, let's start with inventory. The headline number says crude oil drew down 5.1 million barrels, which, of course, is a massive drawdown, not to be completely unexpected, considering this is the first week of summer driving season. But here's the thing. The 5.1 was just the commercial storage number. The real number is 10.5 million barrels, if you include the drawdown, which was recklessly taken out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Very bad policy, in my opinion, but that's what they're doing. So we really drew down 10.5 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, though, building 256,000 barrels. Okay, it's a teensy-weensy little build, but at least it's a build, and we really need it in Cushing because those tanks there are getting really low. Gasoline and distillates both drawing down, but less than a million barrels each. 711,000 barrels of gasoline drawn down, 530,000 barrels of distillates. Summer driving season is here, and we never restocked for it. Remember, the way the system normally works is in the springtime, we see restocking, a long series of builds on inventory, and that puts the extra crude oil and finished products in the tanks so that we can get through the high demand season, which is just beginning right now. So high demand season is here, but we never did the restocking in advance of it. Meanwhile, U.S. production is holding flat at 11.9 million barrels. We had a big move up on WTI over the holiday weekend in thin trading volume, hit $120 a barrel. Then we snapped back to the 13-day moving average, and now we're back up on the inventory news this morning. I still say much higher by Labor Day, but if we have a recession, which I think is still quite possible, as that perception enters the minds of market participants, it could spell a big dip in prices, at least temporarily. Now, if I'm wrong about that and there is no recession, then it's even bigger upside by Labor Day.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold. Ever since the short-term top in the dollar emerged, gold has hit its short-term low and working its way higher. It looks like 1900 is now within reach. Do you think there's some short-term upside on gold, or how do you take it?
Patrick, since we have Ronnie Sterfala in for a gold-centric interview this week, I'm going to save most of the big picture commentary for Ronnie. As I said last week, you know, this rally had paused, and I said, boy, we need to stay above 1830, and we need to resume the rally, get to a new high above where it was a week ago, or whatever the top was previously. Those things have happened now. We stayed above 1830, and with this big rally that we've seen this morning on Thursday, we're back up just toying with the 34-day moving average at 1875. I'd like to get back above the 55 and 100-day moving averages, which are right around between 1890 and 1900. Definitely, if we can get above 1900, then it really starts to look good. I would note, though, that if you really look at the correlation between the stock market and gold, there's a very strong correlation there. So as much as it's kind of tempting to say, oh, well, even if the stock market crashes, that ought to still be good for gold because the fundamentals for gold are different. Well, I think what's happening is when the stock market sells off, people are selling everything, whether it makes sense or not. And that strong correlation says to me that if we get a recession-induced stock market further sell-off, if we get to new lows in the stock market, we'll probably get to new lows in gold at the same time. Right now, it seems like the rally is on in both stocks and gold. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Let's save the rest for Ronnie in today's feature interview.
All right. Well, let's wrap up by touching on the 10-year Treasury yield, which as we approached 320 3 weeks ago, we've been more or less consolidating downwards. It looked like that the short-term bond bottom may be in, but really bonds have started, our yields at least have started to turn right back up. It almost feels like we're ready to crawl back to 3% here. What's your take on the yields?
Well, as I've said for many, many weeks, as long as we stay below 3% on the 10-year yield, I kind of feel like, you know, the situation's under control. We start seeing a break above 3%, especially if we rip substantially above 3%, then I get concerned that inflation is out of control again. We're edging back up over 2.92 this morning, okay, still below 3%. So my overall take is to watch this rather than try to predict an outcome. I don't really have a view on where it's headed, but I think watching whether we stay below 3% is critical.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Incrementum Fund Manager and In Gold We Trust author Ronnie Sterferle. Eric, why did we get Ronnie back on the show this week?
Well, Ronnie has been very popular as a guest, particularly when the new In Gold We Trust reports come out. So we're going to do a quick overview of that. They're expanding. They've got now a combination of a video, and the report is published in different languages and so forth. All of the links for that are in your Research Roundup email. And we're going to get into this question of recession. Is it going to happen or not? And particularly, what does stagflation mean for markets?
Eric's interview with Ronnie is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right after this message from our sponsor.
With inflation reaching a 40-year high, investors are looking toward real assets to help safeguard their portfolio. One asset is rising in popularity. Farmland has consistently provided returns more than double the inflation rate since before 1992. How? Because farmland's value is underpinned by its critical role in the global economy. The country's growing population needs to eat. Farmland is well positioned to maintain its value over time, no matter the economic condition. As the supply of arable land in the United States shrinks each year, high-quality farmland should only become that much more valuable in the long run. Interested in adding farmland to your portfolio? Head to farmtogether.com. Farm Together is tapping into the nearly $3 trillion U.S. farmland market to bring unparalleled access to institutional quality farmland through a variety of products, including crowdfunded farmland offerings, 1031 exchange, sole ownership bespoke offerings, and most recently, the Sustainable Farmland Fund. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ronnie Sterferle, fund manager for Incrementum, perhaps better known as the principal author of the In Gold We Trust report. Now, this report is a big deal, folks. It comes out once a year, and it's completely free. You'll find the download link to the report, as well as the alternate language versions of the report, as well as a video introducing the report, and the slide deck associated with the report, which is what we're going to focus today's interview on. So I do recommend that you have that slide deck in front of you, as we're going to be referring to the graphs and charts it contains extensively throughout this interview. You'll find the download links in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Ronnie, let's start with the big picture. You've been doing this for quite a while now, well over a decade. Tell us a little bit about the history of the report and how we got to where we are today.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me again. Well, actually, this is the 16th annual In Gold We Trust report already. I started as a little analyst doing Asian equities at an Austrian bank. And in 2007, due to a mining stock that I had privately, that developed really well. It was a 40-bagger, which is kind of a blessing, but also a curse, because you think, okay, well, that's just normal in the mining space. I went to my boss and said, well, I would love to write a little bit about gold. And he said, yeah, go ahead. Gold is always interesting. And yeah, back then I started writing about gold, and it's still amazes me. It still fascinates me. And actually, this year, we did hit a new all-time high. It's 400 pages of research about gold, as there's just so much going on. And I think this is really the interesting thing. Gold is not only about supply demand. It's about, obviously, opportunity costs coming from the bond market, from equity markets, from commodity markets. It's about central bank policy. It's about geopolitics. It's about de-dollarization. We cover the topics of ESG in the mining space. We write about mining stocks. Therefore, it's still, as I've said, it truly amazes me. And I think there's lots of, to be honest, rubbish, gloom and doom research out there in the gold space. And we want to make a difference and want to make a solid, sober case for gold. And I think that's what's really missing. And therefore, you know, we're getting feedback from all over the globe. We already have 700,000 downloads for this year's report. So it's really, it's a big thing, and it wouldn't be possible without the support of my staff. So there's 20 people working on the report now.
Ronnie, the title on this year's report is Stagflation 2.0. Now, even old fogies like me were just little kids for Stagflation 1.0 in the 70s. Tell us a little bit more about stagflation and why it is so critical to the gold market.
Well, Eric, when we decided on the leitmotif of this year's report, I think it was in December 2021, we really didn't expect that stagflation would become such a big topic. Now it's really, it has gone mainstream. And for us, it was important to really make a deep dive into this topic. So we really analyzed where the term is coming from. Most people don't know that it was originally coined by the British Member of Parliament, Ian MacLeod, who first used it in 1965, when he explained, well, Great Britain was, I think, reaching the 6% inflation mark, and the economy shrank by roughly 1%. And he back then coined this term. And obviously, there's it has become common usage. And most people would say that the stagflation definition is based on four different pillars. First of all, high inflation. Then secondly, low or negative economic growth. Then thirdly, high unemployment, and fourth, growth below potential growth. But the interesting thing is that actually there's it's a rather qualitative and rather vague definition of stagflation. So what we did, we operationalized it, and we provided our own objectively measurable quantitative definition of stagflation. And then we calculated, you know, what works in stagflation. We analyzed, obviously, the analogs, but also the main differences between the stagflationary 1970s and the stagflation that we're experiencing now. So I think it's really a topic that is, as we found out during our research process, it's very much under-researched, and therefore I think it's a very interesting report, again, focusing on this topic of stagflation 2.0.
Ronnie, you said you've got your own working definition of stagflation. Please share that with our listeners.
So we came up with our own proprietary definition of stagflation, and we define an economy as being stagnant if real economic growth is less than 1% year on year, and we consider inflation to be elevated if it exceeds 3% year on year. And we collect these data on a quarterly basis, and both conditions must be met for at least two consecutive quarters in order to declare stagflation. And additionally, we have also calculated a stagflation strength. So based on this definition, we calculated performances of asset classes, of sectors. And I think this is really a very, very interesting chapter within the report. Now, Eric, I think if we go back like 1 year, so in the middle of the year 2021, basically the transitory narrative was well alive. And basically on this side of the Atlantic and the other side, we finally achieved the monetary policy Elysium, so an inflation rate of 2%. And back then, Isabel Schnabel, the member of the ECB's executive board, she told us, well, actually, we are much more worried about inflation being too low rather than too high. Now, obviously, I think when it comes to inflation, a lot has changed over the last 12 months. Inflation is a big topic again. I think we're really entering an inflationary mindset. And as inflation also has a very strong psychological aspect, I think this is really something that will be very sticky going forward. And we expect several inflation waves, a little bit similar like in the 1970s. However, when it comes to the economy, when it comes to GDP growth, I think most people still believe the narrative that the economy is doing just fine, even though in Q1, US GDP was down already 1.4%. At the moment for the second quarter, I think the Atlanta Fed sees 2% growth, which is far too optimistic in my view, because we see that credit growth is very weak. We see that this inverse wealth effect, as they call it, 28 trillion were basically destroyed year to date in asset markets. So I just don't see that this will not weigh on consumption and on economic growth. Then we're seeing that the University of Michigan consumer sentiment is at the moment at 58 and getting very close to levels that we typically see in recessions. So from my point of view, this combination of very aggressive rate hikes and even more aggressive quantitative tightening, which is now starting in June, added to an economy that is already pretty weak. As I've said, recession is more and more becoming our base case. So therefore, we are already and we will stay in a stagflationary environment for quite a while from my point of view. And this is what the report is mostly about. Shall we perhaps, Eric, I don't know what you think, shall we talk about some of the slides in our slide deck?
Ronnie, let's dive in, and I'm just going to go ahead, since we've already talked about some of the title slides in the beginning, and move to the first substantive slide, which is page 5, where you've got the performance of gold in a number of different currencies charted by year. And what I find fascinating about this, most macroeconomic scholars would agree that inflation generally, and particularly stagflation, should be really good for the price of gold. The thing is, in 2020, we saw really good performance, 25% in U.S. dollar terms, 19.5% as an average across all of the currencies that you're plotting here. But that's before we really had an expectation of major inflation or stagflation. Now that it's become, as you put it, big news, everybody's talking about it, in 2021 and 2022, gold hasn't done very well at all. What's going on here?
Well, I think, I would be a liar if I would say that I'm not at least a bit disappointed about the performance of gold. And I think last year, 2021, I think gold kind of lost its mojo because we saw a very strong performance in 2019 where gold was up 18% in dollar terms and in 2020 up 25%. So it kind of took a breather. And then obviously we saw a very strong US dollar last year, the Dixie being up 8%. We saw very high opportunity costs as the stock market ripped higher. We saw, I think, every 2 or 3 days, new all-time highs in the S&P 500. Then we saw crypto assets that sold a show. And then I think most importantly, last year market participants kind of still believed the transitory narrative. Now, when it comes to 2022, I think as a Euro investor, for example, as a Japanese, you're doing pretty well with gold. In Japanese yen terms, it's up 10.6%. In Euro terms, it's up 8%. And we saw new all-time highs in both currencies. So we should also not forget that the first quarter for gold was pretty good. We almost touched the all-time high on March 8th when gold hit $2,070. But then obviously from mid-April onwards, this correction, this nasty correction did set in. And I think that the gold price had to pay some tribute to the rallying US dollar, but in general also to this brutal risk-off sentiment in markets. And, you know, the Bloomberg Global Aggregate Bond Index is down 11% year-to-date, which is the worst start on record. We see that the Nasdaq is in a bear market, that many of those Katie Wood stocks are down between 50 and 70%. The dollar is still very, very strong. It started into the year at 95, then it ripped higher to 105, and now we're trading at 102. So the first quarter was good. The second quarter, obviously, not so since mid-April. And I think the main reason for that, Eric, is that the market now really believes the hawkish narrative. From our point of view, we're only seeing doves in hawk clothes. And as many people say that Jay Powell is the new Paul Volcker, he isn't. It's like saying that Danny DeVito is the new Brad Pitt. And I think that Ben Bernanke said that in 2015, monetary policy is 98% talk and only 2% action. And from my point of view, this hawkishness that everybody is seeing now with rates at 3.5% next year, with very, very aggressive quantitative tightening. And, you know, out of the, I think there were seven attempts by the Federal Reserve reducing its balance sheet. And six out of those seven QT efforts were followed by a recession. So long story short, I don't see this hawkishness that the market is still believing in. And I think that gold will start ripping higher again as soon as the Federal Reserve and central banks in general will make this U-turn. Is it going to happen very soon? I don't know. I think a last kind of hawkish crescendo should be expected. So I still see one leg lower for equities and yields higher. So what we do in our funds at the moment, we do not buy the dip. We rather sell the rip. But I think this U-turn will probably come. I would see it in the third quarter of this year.
Ronnie, I've been surprised both you and most other analysts that I've been following have had the same view, which is, hey, look, gold did really well in March. And, you know, to me, gold did incredibly poorly in March from the standpoint that gold is supposed to be a hedge against currency debasement, but almost more importantly, a hedge against geopolitical risk. And literally on the day that gold didn't quite make an all-time high, we had the biggest geopolitical escalation since the Cuban Missile Crisis. We literally had the United States and Russia intimating the potential of nuclear escalation as the beginning of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. So to my thinking, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, what if we had this really stagflationary outlook, very strong signs of inflation in the system, and then you get threats of nuclear escalation between the superpowers, I would have said gold, $5,000 easy, if not higher. We didn't even get to 2,200. What's going on here?
Well, I think, Eric, I think the institutional investors are basically the marginal buyers. And if you have a look at ETFs, for example, which are probably the best gauge for investors' demand for gold. You know, we saw big outflows in 2021, especially from North American funds. We have never recovered the losses. In Europe and in Asia, ETF demand is quite stable. But so far, it seems that this marginal buyer being the institutional investors, they haven't really started buying aggressively yet. But I know, you know, from talking to many fund managers, to many private bankers, that those guys are having sleepless nights currently. Q1 was a disaster. Most of those, you know, balanced portfolios, which is a, you know, 60-40 combination or whatever, you know, they were down between 7 and 10%. And the second quarter isn't going particularly well either. So I think over the longer term, there will be quite some significant shifts from institutional players into gold. And I think this is slowly really, really, really starting. But I totally agree, Eric. I mean, what happened on February 26th, when basically the G7 and the European Union said, well, actually, folks, we're going to freeze the US dollar and the euro currency reserves of the Russian Central Bank, which is, you know, 60% of its total international reserves. From my point of view, this will go down in monetary history because, you know, back in the days, we saw, you know, such sanctions against pariah states like Venezuela, Iran, Afghanistan, and so on. But we never had such sanctions being applied against a state with veto power in the United Nations Security Council, against a big nuclear power, and obviously one of the world's most important exporters of commodities. But I think this decision going forward will be pretty positive for gold demand because, first of all, it clearly demonstrates to many U.S. critical nations how quickly U.S. dollar reserves can transform from a highly liquid asset to a useless piece of printed paper. And de facto, the U.S. and the euro area have basically told the whole world that they no longer want to pay their economic quid pro quo from previous trade deals. So I think, you know, going forward, this whole deglobalization and this block building that we are seeing now, which is very, very worrisome from my point of view, this should be an additional case for gold. Because if we see some sort of a monetary multipolarity, I think we will need between the blocks, we will need some sort of an internationally recognized anchor of trust. And I think as gold is, first of all, neutral, it doesn't belong to any state, to a political party or to a dictator or whatever. It can represent the unifying element. Then, secondly, gold has no counterparty risk. And I think this counterparty risk, you know, the Russians saw that quite well. And I think the Chinese also watched this reserve freeze with a wary eye. And thirdly, gold is one of the most liquid assets worldwide. So last year, gold was traded daily to the tune of almost 150 billion. So I think this topic is a big additional driver for gold, but I think we have to be clear. In German, we say eierlegende Wollmilchsau. It's like the English translation would be an egg-laying woolly pig or an egg-laying goose or whatever. So I think people mix up. People think that gold is the solution to all our problems. I think gold works pretty well as a hedge against tail risks. It works pretty well as a currency hedge. It works pretty well in times of turmoil. And it's a highly liquid investment. So therefore, I think it has done okay-ish, but expectations were obviously much, much higher.
Ronnie, let's move on to page 13 in the slide deck. As you said, I love the analogy to Danny DeVito and Brad Pitt. Even if Danny DeVito was Brad Pitt, or if Jay Powell was Paul Volcker, Paul Volcker told us very clearly before he passed away that what he did in the early 80s would never work today because of the debt overhang. So I see on page 13, you're getting into this topic of what happens as we get into a new era here of maybe a different Paul Volcker played by Danny DeVito.
Well, I think, you know, if we have a look at this chart, it's pretty obvious that the Great Moderation is over. And I think that central bankers, politicians, and especially investors still are conditioned by basically four decades of falling inflation rates. And inflation, you know, studying inflation numbers was probably as important as studying the, I don't know, the snow forecast in the Sahara. So it wasn't really for portfolio construction. It wasn't really a big topic. Now, as we see now, we just got for the Eurozone the new inflation numbers. We are running in the Eurozone at 8.1% with core inflation at 4.4. In Germany, the inflation rate is 7.4%. And, you know, just to put that into perspective, Eric, you know, this is the highest since 1981, when I think E.T. premiered in U.S. cinemas. And in 1981, back then, Helmut Schmidt was the chancellor in Germany. So this is really I think that it's pretty clear that this great moderation is over. However, there's a very big difference with the last time we saw inflation at 8%. Well, back then, actually, the key interest rate in Germany was 7.5%, while in the US, it was 16.5%. So obviously, we are seeing the lowest and most negative real rates probably ever. And from my point of view, going forward, as we see some sort of inflation mania, as I've briefly said before, I think that for this inflation wave, we might have seen the highs already. So 5-year break evens are at 2.9%, the 10-year break evens at 2.6%. They are coming down from 3% in April this year. We're seeing 5-year forward inflation expectation rates at 2.3%, which is still kind of anchored. But what gives me confidence that inflation will be around for much longer is the fact that we now really have this inflationary mindset. It reminds me of emerging markets, and it changes our behavior as consumers, as business people, as investors. And I think this inflationary mindset will stick around. Well, of course, in the report, we explain why we see continued inflationary pressure. And you can see that, for example, on page 14 and page 15, producer prices in the euro area are rising at the fastest rate in half a century. Eric, from my point of view, as we study the political developments, and I can tell you over here in Europe, everybody is really, really concerned. But I think it's clear that the era of globalization probably is taking a breather, really big breather. And as globalization has had a big disinflationary impact for decades, deglobalization will have an inflationary effect. I think that Russia will continue to be a pariah state for the Western community for many, many years to come. But I think that the Western world, especially the European Union, is completely underestimating the commodity leverage that Russia, but also probably China has. So Zoltán Pozsa wrote about that a couple of weeks ago, where he said, for the case of Germany, commodity imports, which is mainly energy imports from Russia, that's worth 27 billion, supporting economic activity worth 2 trillion. So I think this leverage effect of commodities has a big impact, not only on the economic development, but also on inflation. And for the European Union, we shouldn't forget that Russia is a major supplier of palladium, which is very, very important for our automotive industry, for fuel cells, electronic applications, and so on. So I think this inflationary pressure will continue to exist. We are writing about the wage price spiral that is just starting to spin over here. You can see it, for example, for the wage growth tracker by the Federal Reserve, Atlanta, it's currently at 6%. So we're really seeing wage pressure kicking in. And therefore, you know, our take is we will see much more inflation volatility. We'll probably see lower inflation going forward. And this will probably also give central banks leeway to put the monetary pause button and to stop their hawkishness. But our take is that inflation will come back because there's so many additional drivers. And therefore, it's crystal clear for us, the Great Moderation is over. And this will have an enormously important impact on portfolio construction.
Well, I think that really is the key distinction in this entire conversation is you're saying, and I agree with you, the Great Moderation is over. But you also said that the marginal buyer of gold is institutional investors. Institutional investors are mostly stuck in the mindset that this whole inflation that we're seeing is just a transitory event, which has been driven by supply chain disruptions thanks to the COVID crisis and now the Ukraine war. And just as soon as those things are over, it's all going back to normal, and we're going to be back into our permanent great moderation that lasts forever. I think you and I agree that's not what's happening here, but the rest of the institutional community doesn't see it that way yet. Any thoughts on what it will take to get through to them?
Well, I think the longer we are above 2% and really at those nasty levels that we are currently in, I think the bigger the pressure will become. And as I've said before, we're talking to lots of institutional players, and for them, they try to make them believe that it's only transitory and that we're going back to the old playbook. But I think the longer we are in a highly inflationary environment, the bigger the pressure will be, especially coming from their investors. So I think it's important, Eric. Gold is not the only solution or the only asset class that works in such an environment that we're talking about. I think Bank of America came out with their FANG 2.0, which is fuels, aerospace, agriculture, nuclear and renewables, and gold and metals and minerals. So that's the new FANG. And from my point of view, you know, commodities, the Bloomberg Commodity Index is up 33% year to date. I think there's still a very, very strong case to be made for commodities. And it's very much the same when it comes to gold. If I talk to institutional players about their commodity allocation, it's basically not existing. Most of them say, well, actually, due to ESG, we're not really allowed to invest in oil and gas anymore. When it comes to copper and so on, when it comes to lithium, when it comes to base metals in general, when it comes to agriculture, there's very, very little expertise in investing in those assets. And most tell me, well, you know, this bull market is already over. Of course, we're not at the beginning of the bull market in commodities, but we are far away from the end of this party. And in the report, we describe, for example, you know, just one thing, Eric, the Net Zero Banking Alliance by the United Nations, it is representing 40% of global banking assets. And they are committed to aligning their lending and investment portfolios with net zero emissions by 2050. So there are all the big banks, you know, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, controlling $66 trillion. And actually, to put it bluntly, these financial institutions commit themselves to reduce emissions by basically starving oil and gas producers of capital. And this is, from my point of view, a very, very strong case to be made for energy, but also for commodities in general. We're seeing this massive underinvestment that we saw over the course of this bear market. You know, we consume roughly 40% more commodities than 15 years ago, for example, for iron ore, for copper. And to me, it's somewhat surprising that CapEx levels are at 15-year lows currently. So the sector has been starved of investments, and I think this is slowly starting now. But from my point of view, it is not only gold that I'm quite confident at, it is also commodities. And as I've said, we haven't seen any swing from large institutional players into the gold space and into the commodity space yet.
Let's come back to the subject of recessions and whether or not one is coming. You know, I get a lot of really, really smart people on this show. I've really been surprised how many of them, even someone like Ola Hansen, who is a commodities guy at heart, sees absolutely no risk of a recession. And it seems to me that the Fed needs to engineer a recession in order to accomplish their goals. On that note, let's move on to page 16 in the deck.
Yeah, well, it shows, you know, we kind of like long-term charts, and this starts in 1915. And actually, only 3 out of 20 rate hikes did not end in a recession. And, you know, if the Fed hikes by 50 bips at the next two meetings and then 25 bips at every other meeting, we will have 3.5 or 3.6% in the middle of next year, which would be significantly higher than in the last tightening cycle, 2019. And, you know, what we're seeing, it's not only very aggressive monetary policy, and the FT had a great article basically saying that we are seeing the most widespread rate rises for over two decades. So policymakers around the world have announced more than 60 increases in interest rates in the past 3 months. It is not only very aggressive hiking, it is also quantitative tightening. And as I've said before, you know, 6 out of 7 QT efforts were followed by a recession. I just don't see that they really will aggressively hike rates and do quantitative easing without causing a nasty recession. And I mean, we're already seeing the consequences. And therefore, I think, you know, just have a look at 30-year fixed mortgages, 5.2% at the moment. It's more than doubled from its lows in 2021. And of course, the housing market suffers already. Lumber is quietly down 50% from its March highs. So obviously, we are moving into a recessionary environment. But obviously, the Federal Reserve will be too late, as they are always. And I just don't see this, soft landing narrative. It just doesn't work out in practice. It's like if I tell my kids, okay, just have one piece of chocolate and then that's it. Yeah, it sounds great in theory, but in practice, it just doesn't work. And you know, if we have a look at slide 19, Eric, where we show the aggregated balance sheet, Federal Reserve, ECB, Bank of Japan, and People Bank of China, and then a global stock and bond market index, we can already see that basically we haven't seen any significant tightening yet. And already stock and bond markets are reversing big time. So, of course, if the Fed continues on its path, if we see 3.6% rates next year, if we see aggressive quantitative tightening, well, obviously, we won't go into recession, but rather into a depression, because we never before in history have we seen such a financialized economy. We've never seen more dependence on high and rising asset prices. So I think it would be really naive to think that, well, they continue with their plan without causing a nasty recession and then without seeing a big monetary U-turn. And I think this is really, you know, now, if you have a look at the ISM, for example, Eric, the Federal Reserve usually cuts interest rates when the ISM is below 50. Based on our calculations, and the ISM is already slowing big time, we could cross the 50 by July or August already. The euro dollar curve is already starting to price in rate cuts. So I think we are already seeing that the market is kind of anticipating this reversal, but still market participants believe in this very, very hawkish narrative that they try to communicate.
Ronnie, you've got a whole bunch of terrific slides in this deck. Unfortunately, we don't have time to cover every one of them. I want to move on, though, to page 26. Talk about the commodity super cycle, where it's headed, and what you see next.
Well, this is, you know, another very long-term chart of commodity prices. And you can tell that every high first of all, that there's very long cycles in the commodity space. And we can see that we experienced a brutal bear market in commodities. And in 2020, we said, well, you got to load up on commodities. And so far, it's doing pretty well. And we can also see on this chart that for every bull market, obviously, it went significantly higher than the previous high. So this would suggest that perhaps we're halfway through this cycle, but we're not close to the end of this commodity cycle. And I think, Eric, first of all, what's important, and I talked to, about this already, is the underinvestment, the CapEx cycle that we're seeing in the commodity space. But then we're also seeing this this green demand, which is becoming much more important going forward. And you know, just one example for Tesla at its battery day last year, they said that they are projecting 3 terawatt hours of lithium battery capacity needed in 2030 for the EVs and storage that they expect to produce. Well, actually, to reach this target, Tesla alone would gobble up roughly 75% of the world's current nickel production and 4 times the world's current lithium production. And this is just Tesla alone. And if you walk around over here in Europe, you can tell that EVs are really becoming a big thing, and that of course they are heavily subsidized. But I think, you know, this green demand is still being underappreciated by many investors, especially in the commodity space. And if you have a look at slide 27, I can tell that, you know, the commodity producers are indeed cash flow monsters at the moment. For example, you know, in our funds, we've got a couple of big names, you know, Vale, for example. They generated about $20 billion in free cash flow last year, which is pretty good for a company with around $100 billion market cap and no debt. They paid out $10 billion in dividends last year. And it's not only Vale, it's also Rio Tinto, it's Shell, it's BP, it's Glencore. All those companies are funneling cash back to their shareholders. So what we really see in the commodity space is deep value. We saw that over the bear market in commodities, most of the companies really cleaned up their balance sheets, and now they're in a fantastic shape and they're giving back their earnings to their shareholders. And I think this is still very much underappreciated, especially by institutional players. So I'm still heavily confident when it comes to the commodities space in general. It has rewarded us very well since the beginning of the year in our funds. And still, you know, I'm seeing, you don't have to go into the junior space, into the small cap space. You can stick with the large names to find tremendous amounts of value on their balance sheets.
Ronnie, let's tie this all together. It seems like we agree that all the fundamentals really, really are very, very strongly in favor of gold. Yet, curiously, it hasn't really moved as much as either of us would have expected yet. So what do we do from here? Is this a hurry up and wait situation where you just have to have faith in your fundamentals? Or is it time to look deeper into why it hasn't responded as we thought it would?
Well, I have to say I'm pretty relaxed about the performance of gold, especially compared to most other asset classes. And we shouldn't forget that it has stood up to collapsing equities, bonds, and crypto markets, and also against the rallying US dollar. But I think that we should only expect real upward momentum, Eric, for the price of gold when this turnaround in monetary policy starts. And when that's going to happen, that's obviously the crucial question. As I've said, I think some sort of a last hawkish crescendo should be expected. So we don't think that we already saw the bottom in equity markets and that we saw the top in bond yields. And I think at some point, well, first of all, it's illusory that the Federal Reserve can really deprive the market of the punch bowl. And I don't think that this transformation of doves into hawks will really last. And because at some point they will see the consequences of monetary tightening, which is a recession that is looming, aggressively rising yields, stock markets doing poorly, bankruptcies, unemployment. So at some point we will see this U-turn. What instruments or what rabbits can central bankers pull out of their heads? Well, at some point, perhaps renewed QE or QQE, then I think we will see much more financial repression. I think Russell Napier is talking about that very eloquently. I think that a yield curve control at some point will be implemented. I'm expecting much more fiscal stimulus. We write in the report, you know, the US is as far away from a balanced budget as Joe Biden is from puberty. So I think, you know, going forward, the big question is, what would really make me nervous when it comes to gold? And I think it's really a sustained move into positive real rates, which is, as we write in the report, it's as likely as a remarriage between Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. So I don't really see that. For the shorter term, Eric, we had a close look in the report at the seasonality and especially at the seasonality of gold in midterm election years. And actually, June is, after May, the second weakest month in election years, so in midterm election years. So perhaps we should expect some further headwinds over the next coming weeks. But I think, you know, we should really buy the dips in every gold correction. As soon as we see this monetary U-turn, I think gold will rip higher. And I can clearly see that we'll go to $2,200 by the end of this year.
Ronnie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about what you do at Incrementum, and particularly for our accredited investor audience who are qualified to invest in your funds. Tell us a little bit more about what's on offer there and how they can contact you for more information.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Well, actually, Incrementum is an owner-managed asset manager, boutique asset manager based in Liechtenstein. We manage 6 investment funds, most of them, I would say, in the commodities and the precious metal space. We also have 2 funds that combine gold with Bitcoin, where we basically harvest the volatility, the enormous volatility of Bitcoin, but also of mining stocks, for example. So, yeah, that's what we do besides writing lengthy reports about gold. And you can contact me, have a look at our webpage, incrementum.li. I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's at Ron Stoefele. And you can download this year's In Gold We Trust report in English, German, but also for the very first time in Spanish. And we've got a Mandarin edition on our webpage, ingoldwetrust.report.
Ronnie, we look forward to getting you back again for an update in a few months. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Ronnie back on the show. You know, he always does give a nice objective view to gold, and certainly interesting to see how many of his calls are going to come to fruition this year. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, I'm still stuck on the same thing that I've been stuck on for many months here on Macro Voices, which is Ronnie makes excellent arguments. Stagflation, we saw in the 1970s, produced incredible returns for gold. There's very strong arguments to say that stagflation 2.0, as Ronnie calls it, is coming back. Seems like a really good setup for gold. I love the story. But hang on, this has been playing out for a while. Normally, markets tend to lead and anticipate the data. And what we're seeing here is the data's already come in and pretty much proven all the things that were predicted to take the gold price over $3,000, and it hasn't happened yet. So what's going on? Is crypto stealing the market share? Is it something else? I don't know. And I think it's important to realize, too, when you talk about, oh, wow, the 1970s stagflation was such an incredibly rewarding time for gold investors. Well, hang on. We came in 1971 out of gold being at a artificially low fixed price of $35 an ounce under the Bretton Woods system. When President Nixon took us off of Bretton Woods, obviously there was massive upside in the 1970s because we came from a starting price that was artificially low because it was literally, you know, controlled by the government and set below its true value. So I don't think you can say it's certain to be a repeat of the 1970s in terms of performance. Anyway, let's move on to this week's post-game chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, the title is What's Next for the Markets? What's next for the markets?
All right. Well, let's start on page two with the S&P 500. And one of the things we talked about last week was how oversold the market was. And we saw that there was an attempt in late May for a break to a lower low. Didn't stick. All the makings were there for simply the market to have a relief rally. And my view back then was that we could easily see a move back to 4,200-4,300 on reaction. And it mirrors a lot of the kind of rallies we saw in late January and mid-March, where there were these bear market rallies that kind of just relieved some very oversold conditions. The question really now is that, is this something different, or is it to be just expected to be the same? You know, going into next week, there's still room for this S&P 500 to tack on an extra 100 points and kind of grind higher a little bit on the short term. But we're coming to a really important judgment moment where if this bear market has still got teeth, then the traders are going to start using this strength to sell into, and we should see the market start to roll over. And that's going to be the thing to watch definitely into next week.
Let's move on to the dollar index on page three. What do you make of this chart?
Well, I just marked the 100 line, which conveniently works to very close to where the 50% retracement of the entire bull run since the start of the year lies. And typically, whenever you have a bull trend, often the secondary corrections are about half of the length of the prior rises. And so we have a situation where, you know, the market at this juncture, or the dollar anyway, has had a great run, and now we're giving some back. To me, whether the dollar remains in a bull trend and starts to turn back up is whether in the coming week or two, we see that dollar index sustain above the 100 level. And I like it because it's a nice round number. And generally, while we may even temporarily poke below the 100 level here or there, higher on some consolidation. If we generally see that level hold, I think that this will be a very key kind of pivot area where the dollar may once again go back to reset testing its highs or even making another bull push. I think with it's important to give the bulls the benefit of the doubt on the short to intermediate trend. I know you were referencing during the market wrap, you know, the Luke Groman kind of scenario where inevitably the dollar will go through a weakness cycle, but that may not be the story for 2022. And whether there is another full bull leg ahead is, in my mind, all about whether or not this dip gets bottom on the dollar.
You know, great minds think almost alike. You're using a fib retracement. I was just looking at the peaks just below the left edge of your red line there, right around 99. But everything else you said, I'm exactly on the same page. It's basically if we stay above wherever that support should be, you say 100, I say 99, you know, whatever, in there somewhere. If we can stay above that, I think that all indications are that the dollar rally is still on. If we saw a break substantially below 99, you know, closing a weekly close below that, I'd start to reconsider that view. Now, normally, when we talk about the dollar, you like to also look at the dollar-euro chart. But this week, you've got the dollar-Japanese-yen chart. How come the change?
Well, it's just highlighting because this is the one that's sort of bucking the trend of all the other cross currencies. And so while you know, we've seen like the CAD and the Aussie all kind of move in unison with this dollar pullback, what we've seen here, first of all, the Japanese yen during the US dollar against the Japanese yen anyway, between March and April had an extraordinary 2000 pip run on the upside. Just it was where the dollar strength was most evident. And that while we've seen that consolidation in the dollar, there's a very distinct breakout attempt here on the US dollar against the yen. And the last time this US dollar yen cross was where the bull run started. And so I'll be really curious whether or not that US yen chart breaks to a fresh new high and whether that really starts to advertise that the next dollar leg higher may be underway. And so watching as we approach this highs and what happens into next week is certainly going to be on my mind. With that said, Eric, I want to move on to page 5 where I have that crude oil chart. And we were talking about the break on the July contract of those March highs as being something significant. And we definitely saw an attempt to break above those highs. It gave initially some of it back. But what was interesting is that going into the OPEC meetings, we saw a little bit of a pullback. It was, you know, a few dollars down on the day and almost immediately reversed and got bought on dip. And when I see that type of price action, it means that this is being still very well accumulated. And it really looks like this bull trend is still intact. When I look at this, I just don't see how we don't see 120, 125 in the coming week. It just oil looks so strong here. The other thing to observe was the fact that gasoline futures continue to pump higher. Nat gas reversed back up. So these energies continue to be the strong bull market part of the commodity space. And I don't see any reason for that to change. Do you have a view that's any different than that?
No, I think that's very similar to my view. All I would say is what it would take to turn this around is one of two things. Either you get widespread belief that a recession is imminent in the United States. As much as I think there's a good argument to be made for that, it's a very unpopular view. And as long as that view stays unpopular, oil keeps going up, not down. The other thing would be some huge resolution of some kind. You know, there's a truce between Russia and Ukraine, and they decide to settle their differences and, you know, everybody gets happy and there's no more sanctions against Russia. I just can't see that happening either. So I think it's up, up and away. And when you consider that we didn't restock inventories during the spring, it's a setup for this summer. By the time we get into August, late August, I think we could be looking at substantially higher prices, well above 130, maybe even a new all-time high above 147, which was the previous high from 2008. Let's move on to gold. We heard Ronnie's take. What's yours?
You know what? I think Ronnie really does have like a bigger picture view, which I think is something that I generally agree with. I would label myself a gold bull generally. But my concern on the short term has been very much that it seems that gold has been more or less a cross currency to the US dollar. And when the US dollar had its substantial strength, it weighed heavily on gold when priced in US dollars. And that now that we've seen the dollar in this type of a correction, it's allowing some of that pressure to be taken off, and we're getting a bounce in gold, no different than we're having a correction in the dollar. This, you know, naturally would push gold towards 1900, and on page 7, where the silver chart could push it to 23, 23 and a half. But my spidey senses are kind of in the camp that if the dollar was to suddenly reverse and begin another bull run, it could easily, on the short term, push gold right back down to the bottom end of its ranges. And I think that in order for gold to set up for a more meaningful bull run, I think that we're going to really have to see how the dollar story plays out. And, you know, that's obviously just one of the scenarios, but that's the one that I think I want to be tracking here for the next couple of weeks and see whether that correlates.
Patrick, let's move on to copper futures on page 8. Now, look at the size of that green candle.
Yeah, no, and I'm actually a little bit surprised. But we are seeing a lot of these industrial metals all have a very positive reaction. Even the iron ore plays having a really good run in the last couple of days. And this copper breakout here came right into the 450 level, which was a very important pivot for me. And one of the big things to watch here is whether or not going into next week, copper gives back the breakout attempt. I don't have a chart, for instance, on something like Bitcoin, but when we saw that Bitcoin breakout candle earlier this week, almost immediately came a sell candle that gave back the entire breakout. And that usually is a sign of the distributive market. And what I'm going to be watching on copper is whether something similar to that happens. Like, will we see that traders come in and use this strength to sell into? Is this green candle advertising the beginning of another bull run in these commodities? One day doesn't make a new trend. So I'm going to be watching very much over the next 3-4 trading sessions as to how the bulls respond to this breakout and whether or not they follow through on it.
Well, listeners will have to tune in next week to find out how that goes. Or if you don't want to wait that long, you can also sign up for a free trial of Big Picture Trading and get Patrick's chart decks every single day of the week. Information on pages 9 and 10 of the chart deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com. Diversify your portfolio with U.S. farmland, one of the most inflation-protected and recession-resilient asset classes in the world, now available to all accredited investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the slide deck from Ronnie, as well as the chart deck we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to a number of articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.